This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 60 years ago this week, Soviet troops liberated Auschwitz, the Nazi death camp in southern Poland. They found nearly 7,000 prisoners there that day. On Thursday, some of those survivors and some of the liberators will meet again at Auschwitz to remember the nearly 1 million people killed there, to reflect on the lessons of the Holocaust, and to urge the world never to forget. This anniversary will be bittersweet, not just because of the horror of Auschwitz, but because this also may be the last time so many eyewitnesses gather. Every year there are fewer survivors, and one day, not too long from now, there will be no more eyewitnesses to the Holocaust. This anniversary offers a moment to pause and ask, what happens to history, to collective memory, once all the eyewitnesses are gone? In the lifetimes of many of those listening, the Civil War, the end of slavery, and the First World War have all slipped from living memory. The same will inevitably happen to the Depression, the Second World War, and Korea, the Civil Rights Movement. How does the disappearance of eyewitnesses change history? Does it become less sacred, less political, more distant, or more accessible? On today's program, we'll consider the complicated relationship between eyewitnesses and history. If you have seen history, recorded it, or if you teach it, call and tell us what happens when those who lived it are gone. That's both for dramatic events and for the stories of your family. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, Hollywood history in the making. We'll talk about today's Oscar nominations. But we begin with the Holocaust and the extraordinary effort of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum to preserve eyewitness accounts. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Dan Napolitano, Acting Director of the Museum's Education Division. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
What are you doing about the inevitability of the day when first-person accounts are no longer available?
Well, it's exactly a central question that everyone's asking. We're quite conscious of the fact that the center of Holocaust education has been the survivor. That's not always been the case because it took a long time for the voice to come out. But certainly in the 80s and since we opened in the 90s, most Holocaust education is focused around the survivor. When we lose that personal connection, we have two central things or three primary elements to work with. First is recorded testimony. The Holocaust is one of the most documented periods in history just because of the way the war ended. And so we'll be turning towards recorded video documentaries and recorded testimony. Memoirs are still there. And of course, there's still the testimony of all the people who have heard that survivor generation speak.
Mm-hmm. Yet the power of the story changes, doesn't it?
Well, it's an interesting thing. There is absolutely nothing that can replace a first-person account of an actual event. But it's an inevitable fact. And so what happens now is we take these recorded testimonies and we need to think about how they can be used in the classroom or learning situation. If someone gave 6 hours of testimony on something, rare is the individual is going to sit down and listen to 6 hours. But imagine the scenario where a classroom teacher is able to take 10 minutes of a liberator story, 10 to 12 minutes of a survivor story, 10 to 12 minutes of a bystander, and 10 to 12 minutes of a historian, and create a small documentary voice that tries, it doesn't replace, but tries to capture the multiplicity of voices in an event to, again, personalize history.
Yet there is a sense of the universe of information suddenly becoming finite, and inevitably some document is going to wash up from some, you know, cellar or basement somewhere, and somebody's going to say, aha, we never knew that in this situation they wanted, and there's nobody to go back to and ask anymore.
Well, one of the challenges of oral testimony is that it's very personal. And oftentimes the questions that historians in the world are asking are very impersonal. What are the facts or the objectives? What actually occurred? And so the blending of the personal testimony through memoir and video recorded testimony and historical documentation actually gives the best balance of insight. Again, what you're waving there is an artifact. What you're waving there is a personal connection to the history that now can be juxtaposed to the human, you know, living voice, but there's still a place and a context to join the voice through video or memoir and the artifact, which does give a personal tangential physical connection. and the historical or factual presentation of information.
What about eyewitnesses themselves? What are they worried about, that their stories will be changed, forgotten?
Certainly. One of the great gifts of the United States government to the survivor community is the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Many of them worried more that their story would be forgotten, but once the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum became a reality, they come, they work there. We have 60 or 70 volunteers who are survivors who work with us, and they know that their voice will be carried on. Now, the interesting thing is whenever a survivor speaks to a student group or an adult group, there's often the request, please share this story. In other words, civilization is about continuing the voice of one generation to the next in as rich and dynamic and as accurate a method as possible.
In one sense, though, there are political sensibilities, sensitivities, that are not possible when survivors of the Holocaust are still alive.
We certainly are always sensitive to the voice of the individual who was there, the liberator, the survivor, the individual who suffered the experience, and we always honor that. And I think we will continue to do that. In any discussion, each person's direct connection will engage itself in the dialogue. And so I hope, as someone who's worked at the museum and knowing the people who work there and the large field of Holocaust education and Holocaust research, there's going to be a tremendous effort to remember and to capture not only what was said, but the manner in which it was said and the priorities that were set.
Technology is another issue. Obviously, as
yes.
you said, a lot of this material was recorded at the time, yet everybody knows technology can be manipulated, changed.
Right.
That's another concern.
Well, exactly. That is a challenge. The rich thing is that most testimony has been recorded more recently than previously. And so that a lot of the documentation is on current materials, and it's done responsibly, so that these aren't just lying around for someone to manipulate as they'd want. What's more challenging is what was recorded and what wasn't. I mean, we're going to have a testimony, but for example, quite often the people who were recording, if they were really well guided, knew when someone was telling a unique story. We're talking about Auschwitz now and the anniversary, and too often there's a case where the interviewer said, tell me about Auschwitz. So you end up with lots and lots of stories about Auschwitz, but what about the period of time prior to their arrival to Auschwitz when so many of those people had very unique experiences, and did we get enough of those stories? And there is a tremendous effort by our museum, by the Shoah Foundation, and other organizations around the world trying to make sure that we not only capture a lot of voices, but as diverse an opinion or diverse experiences as possible.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk with Kristen. And Kristen's with us from St. Louis.
Hi. I just wanted to express my concern that if people don't give their eyewitness testimony, that people will, popular opinion might change history later. For example, there's a woman named Michelle Malkin going around now trying to convince people that the internment of Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor was bombed was totally logical and okay. My mother-in-law was interned at Tule Lake, and she's a Japanese American who was living in Tacoma as a child, and her family was interned. Now, my father-in-law was a Japanese American as well, but he was living in Hawaii, and he was working as a carpenter on the military bases there, and he was allowed to roam freely around because, of course, the people there knew that if they interned all the Japanese Americans in Hawaii, there would be nobody doing the work. So there was really no, you know, argument for interning Japanese Americans on the mainland either, because, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, he worked as a carpenter at Pearl Harbor as a Japanese American, and nobody said, hey, this is too risky to let him work on this base. He might be a traitor.
Well, Kristen, perhaps the answer to the argument might be the apology issued by the President of the United States not so many years ago, but this is an issue certainly that comes up with the Holocaust and apology.
It's a great question, and it does apply across different historical moments. In a sense, this woman here is the answer, because civilization, culture has a responsibility to its past. And when the actual person who lived the experience isn't here, there is what we call in our speak, the second generation, the third generation, the daughter, the grandchildren, and then whoever heard that testimony. There's an obligation, if you hear the testimony of someone who's been through that experience, to not only understand it, but to embrace it and be sure to, you know, commit oneself to testifying appropriately so that when people try to distort the facts, you can say no. Not only can we document this, but we have, you know, I heard, or, you know, my grandparents, to emphasize their personal connection. The story does not die.
Mm-hmm.
The generation fades, but it has been told and documented, and individuals who carry that need to stand up and no longer be a bystander to the misappropriation of history, but to engage themselves in the dialogue.
Yet these stories are not always, certainly they're almost always painful for these people to relate, veterans of World War II.
Sure.
And these are not always victims. These are sometimes people explaining things that they would rather forget.
Yes. I mean, there's a great emphasis in our museum right now and around the world to the liberators, to those soldiers who didn't know that they were going to save this remnant of the Jewish people. They were fighting a war. In many cases, they stumbled upon these camps. How did they process that? And they've given oral testimony. And so we often now, when possible, have a survivor and a liberator speaking together, offering their dual sense. Because from our perspective, it's the moment when the liberator began to hear the survivor's story that Holocaust education began.
Dan Napolitano, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dan Napolitano is Acting Director of the Education Division at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from the break, we'll continue our discussion on the role of eyewitnesses in preservation of history. Coming up next, we'll also be talking about how a documentary filmmaker deals with bringing the recent and not-so-recent past to life. I'm Neil Conan. The number to call if you'd like to join us is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about history, remembrance, and eyewitnesses. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. How we remember major events such as the Holocaust or the Civil War affects our present and our future. Joining us now to talk about this complicated relationship between eyewitnesses and history is David Blight, a professor of history at Yale University, also the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, and he's with us from the studios at Yale. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
In your book, you write about something you describe as the memory war. What's that?
Well, the memory war in America over the Civil War was the struggle between Northerners and Southerners, blacks and whites, on all sides, to construct a narrative, a story, a remembrance converted into a narrative and a story about the meaning and memory of the war. Any great divisive event in anyone's history produces this phenomenon. After such a traumatic event that tears a country apart, that leads to fundamental changes, forces that culture, forces that society to have a contest, or if you like, a war over the struggle to create the narrative of what the event had been about.
And when did that war end?
It's not clear that it ever has. It's not clear that it ever has. In our popular culture today, in schooling, in tourism, and in some political issues, we find the memory and meaning of the Civil War popping up, whether it's in debates over the Confederate battle flag or debates about what ought to be interpreted at Civil War sites or debates over how we face our past with slavery or don't face it, how we face the transformations of the U.S. Constitution that occurred during the Civil War or don't, the meaning of the 14th Amendment, the meaning of the 13th Amendment, and so on. The Civil War was that kind of fundamental transformative event, the results of which we may perhaps always live with.
Did the death of the Civil War generation, how did that alter this memory war?
Well, it altered in the same sense, I suppose, as we may see happening with World War II and the Holocaust. That is, when the last surviving soldiers, when the last of the generation that fought the war began to die off, and the last did die off in the 1930s and 40s, mm-hmm. by and large, then we're talking about the history beyond memory. Now memory has had to be passed on to new generations. And when that happens, with any fundamental event, that's when all the engines or the sources of historical memory kick in, from political rhetoric to schooling to publishing to commemorative rituals, rites, the media, the arts, and today the power of film, television, and all the other mediums through which we construct versions of the past and contend with one another to sort of own that past. When there are no longer any eyewitness survivors, now it's the broader culture in all of its manifestations that constructs a national memory or a local memory or a regional memory or even a racial memory, if that term can be used. Mm-hmm. It becomes the history beyond memory, and then it's a struggle over the politics of memory.
And as you say, that struggle continues with the events of the Civil War, and we certainly saw it play out in the events of the Vietnam War during the presidential election campaign.
We did indeed, right when we thought maybe the Vietnam War had pretty much gone into the past as a political issue, it rose its ugly head. And it will always be useful as long as Americans contend over the meaning of their foreign policy, because Vietnam is America's only modern lost war. And how we lost that, why we lost it, what really happened, whether it was an immoral war, whether it was a noble cause, these very different narratives, these very different stories will always be there for us to go back and appropriate and use.
Yet, does it make a difference, certainly to an historian, to be able to say in the case of the Vietnam War, you can go back and talk to not only the people, the survivors who were on those boats and the mm-hmm. Americans who served, but go back and talk to the Vietnamese who lived there and say, what happened? What's your memory of this?
Oh, it's very helpful, and no historian would tell you that eyewitness accounts, oral histories, memoirs, reminiscences are not extremely valuable. They are extremely valuable. This is especially the case for those of us who study slavery. But at the same time, and I think this perhaps can also be said of Holocaust testimonies, mm-hmm. that the eyewitness of a deeply traumatic experience of suffering in a particular place and time is not necessarily the source we want to go to understand larger meanings, larger problems of causation and consequences. Now, those oral histories and testimonies in the aggregate can tell us a great deal about the nature of that experience, and they can tell us a great deal about the meaning of that experience as individuals faced it. But it's a little bit like asking the common soldier in a war, the common soldier at the Battle of the Bulge, what was the war all about? Well, he'll probably tell you it was about freezing his hands off and feeling frightened to death and half-starved on a winter day in France. And the larger picture he couldn't see. Mm-hmm. The Holocaust survivor, their memories are not only traumatized by terrible suffering, but they're riveted in specific modes of memory, specific moments, especially ironic moments that tend to stick in the mind. And I think one thing that needs to be said here about the difference between what we might call history and what we might call memory is that sometimes in our culture anyway, we do have a tendency to really put our faith in the eyewitness account. And there's a good reason for that, as I've suggested, and not so much put our faith in the more formal modes of creating knowledge, in scholarship, in learning. It's a little bit like the memoir versus documentation. If we lose survivors, they die off of a particular event, if that event still has, as your previous guest, Mr. Napolitano, said, if that event has enormous documentation, as did the Holocaust, as did the American Civil War, we can still know a great deal about it, and we might even get to a deeper understanding through careful uses of that documentation.
And just to stem the tide of emails, yes, we know the Battle of the Bulge happened in Luxembourg for the
part.
But anyway,
Let's
get a caller on the line. Ben calls us from Rochester, New York.
My uncle was in that battle, I should know.
Ben, go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling from Rochester, Minnesota.
I apologize for that.
That's okay. My grandfather, he was a World War I veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And he belonged to some Rainbow Brigade. He was a corporal in the Army. He told what it was really like. He said, it was just really horrible. The trenches, they ate the shoes off their feet, the mustard gas, how they had to basically sneak up and kill the enemy to get food because they didn't have enough provisions provided. Sounds a little familiar, like today almost. Not enough provisions.
And I wonder, when you think about your children and how they would learn his story, you can't introduce them to him anymore. You could show them pictures.
Right, right. And he showed us pictures as we grew up, but he didn't really open up and tell a lot of the stories that he told us later, of course, what it was really like. He says, it's just nothing but, bombs exploding, dirt and mud flying in the air, horses getting blown up, just arms and legs, everything, just guts flying everywhere all over everybody. It was nothing glorious. It was nothing wonderful.
Did you record any of that, sir? Did you even write down any of that discussion?
Actually, my sister is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of the family historian.
Mm-hmm.
But, I've got it recorded up in my mind for now. But you're right. A person does need to put it down in print or other media.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing he mentioned is a little story about a Finnish soldier who was fighting with the Allied command in Europe at the time. And he was kind of high-strung, apparently, but he was a good soldier and kind of funny and everything else. And one day he had a little lull in the fighting. He went off for a walk and didn't come back. And the commanding officer sent my grandfather and another soldier up to go find him. They found him all right. They found him up behind a tree and slit his own throat because he couldn't stand the pressure anymore.
Well, you remind me of the thousands and thousands of memoirs and reminiscences that Civil War soldiers wrote about their experiences. But what can sometimes happen is that the kind of story that a veteran might tell his family, is not always the same kind of story that same veteran might actually publish, because it depends on the larger culture, it depends on the publishing industry, it depends on the medium in which this story is going to be put out. What happened with Civil War soldiers is that eventually by the 1880s and 1890s, 20 and 30 and even 40 years out after the war, their memoirs were cleaned up. They were essentially sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the rare, rare remembrance or memoir of a Civil War soldier that actually told of the true horrors of combat. There are some, and they do creep through in those reminiscences. But what one might tell one's children over time, or what one might record as an old man, is not always what a larger culture wants to hear from a surviving witness.
Hmm. Ben, thanks very much for the call.
Could I add one more thing, please?
Go ahead.
Okay. My major fear of all this is not only that it will be lost, but we're doomed to repeat our mistakes. As you say, they're sanitizing things as time goes on. But I feel as though they're sanitizing things right now with the war in Iraq. We're not really getting the full picture, the clear picture of what's really going on from what I've heard from the firsthand accounts coming back from people I know. And that's kind of scary because people can't make good decisions based on inaccurate or incomplete information.
Ben, thanks for the call.
You betcha. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Once a story becomes part of history, it can be hard to introduce a new version or to rewrite history. Film can be a powerful tool to help us see things differently and think about them in new ways. Joining us now is Noland Walker, a documentary filmmaker, co-director of the film Citizen King. He's with us from his home in Philadelphia. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. How are you?
Very well. And I know that in addition to Citizen King, where obviously you're talking to a lot of people who were witnesses to the events of his life and the circumstances, I know you've made documentaries about slavery as well.
Yes. I made a film in a series called Africans in America, which was a look at the breadth of American history. Actually, David Blythe was in that film.
Hey.
Hi, Nolan.
Hi, David. How are you?
Well, good, fine.
Let me just ask you, if I would, what's the difference between working with, primary, firsthand, eyewitness sources saying what happened when Dr. King did X, and working with the finite universe of the documentary record for slavery?
Right. The thing is, in terms of film, you're trying to balance. It's a distilled version of history, and film is primarily a visceral medium and an emotional medium that you shape and frame. And so, when you're dealing with eyewitnesses, you know, there's a very noted documentarian named John Else once said, "There's nothing like a talking head," and he said that in a positive sense because it's the person who was there, whose, you know, eyes and ears were at a particular event and could then relate, who is then relating that event to you. On film, that plays with a much greater urgency, immediacy, often than say a document. And so the challenge is to figure out ways to make documents, letters, even historical locations, you know, feel as immediate as a person, as a human being. And, you can't, so you supplement that with historians, with either descendants of historical figures or, some well-known, some not well-known. And it's an ongoing challenge.
We're talking about history, memory, and eyewitnesses. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there is Noland Walker, as you're looking for sources of information to project in a film about slavery, it's very limited. I mean, there is no B-roll.
Right. There is no archival footage from slavery. And one of the things that we did was go to historical locations and shoot a lot down in South Carolina, Mississippi. My film dealt with slavery during the American Revolution, so I shot on George Washington's Mount Vernon plantation and estate. But you also, in using kind of the atmospherics of those places, because those places do have details which can tell us something, we used letters, we used slave narratives, and for that you hire actors or you have people in front of the camera, who are performing in evocative scenes that can touch upon the reality of what happened, but it's more akin to poetry than actually being right there with the camera witnessing an event.
Let me ask you one other question, and this is about your more recent work or the work, more contemporary work, let me put it that way.
Yes.
And I've done the same thing myself. When you interview people who've seen something, you take what you need and you throw away the rest.
Yes.
Do you still throw away the rest?
In what sense?
In the sense that somewhere now is there the entire record of that interview with Andy Young about Dr. King?
Yes, actually, one of the great things about, believe it or not, the internet is that now when a television show is broadcast on public television or on HBO or whatever, a documentary, a lot of times there will be a website and excerpts from the interview or the entire interviews are sometimes logged and transcripted and they reside, they have a life outside of the film.
I can hear the historian breathing a sigh of relief as we say that.
Keep it all.
Let's get a caller in on this. Pat joins us from Kansas City.
Hello, I'm Pat Lamb. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and every year we take a group of high school kids to Dallas to study the JFK assassination, and we speak to live witnesses as well as watch documentary films on the bus. And it's just very interesting to watch. You know, the kids come back year to year we lose more of these eyewitnesses, but we go to the actual places. And one year we had Ed Hoffman, who's a deaf gentleman, and one of the kids could interpret for him, and he's standing behind the picket fence telling us what he saw there and going right to the place where he saw it, and this had such a profound effect on these kids. And it was one of those things, he always came and spoke at the hotel, and this year he just happened to be, saw him in the Dealey Plaza area. And it's just an incredible learning experience, this living history with the kids, and I love this program because it's so appropriate to what my experience is.
Nolan Walker, you're losing your sources for those Civil War, civil rights, excuse me, reminiscences.
Yes, I see. One of the things that we did this film, Citizen King, on the last 5 years of Martin Luther King's life. And one of the reasons that we did it, and I believe this gentleman hit upon kind of what's important about a recent history film, is that we wanted to interview people who the history, for whom, who lived the history and who may not be around in 10 or 15 or 20 years. Yes. Now, granted, a lot of the people who participated in the civil rights movement were young then, and they are still in many ways young now. But one of our interviewees, a woman named Deni Drew in Alabama, who we just kind of stumbled across in Birmingham, who was a dear friend of Dr. King's family, and used to call him Mike, which was his original name before his father changed his name at the age of 5 after a...
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to thank Pat for his phone call, and Noland Walker, thank you so much for your time today. We'll continue this conversation after a short break. This is NPR News. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about the Oscars. If you have questions about which films were nominated, which weren't, and how the studios manage Oscar campaigns, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's now finish up our conversation on history, memory, and eyewitnesses. Our guest is David Blight, the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American History, with us from the studios at Yale University in New Haven. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Mike. Mike's calling from Palm Coast in Florida.
Hi, Mike Eater speaking. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, a couple things real quick. Since you got a guest from the Civil War, my grandfather experienced the Civil War in a... one hand removed it, so to speak. The Hatfield-McCoy feud, he was, his grandfather was a, I mean, his grandmother was a McCoy, married to a, his father.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Hatfield-McCoy feud, a lot of that came from a lot of the sources of that feud were a result of the Hatfield being Southern sympathizers, Court McCoys being primarily Northern sympathizers. And that carried in all the way up to the local history, and I'd love to have heard the details of some of these events, because they moved up into northeastern Montana, a lot of the those people from that area.
Mm-hmm.
And as late as 1904, 1905, according to the one of the documents I read, the first Hatfield came into the community, and the result was that the McCoys met him at the railroad station to see if he was going to cause problems.
Hmm.
Now, I would love to have heard there was there, but I never had a chance to hear the stories from him. I heard this from other documents. But I had one thing I wanted to ask you real quick on institutional memory. And has anybody ever looked at some of the documentation that came out of the that I run into when I was applying for West Point? They actually had a document that we were required to sign off on in mm-hmm. our application that listed all the terrorist organizations that we had to deny being a member of to qualify.
Right.
Included in that were, I'd say around 50 or 60, at least a third of them were related to the Civil War.
Really?
That's what I call a institutional memory.
Or an institutional grudge, perhaps. let me get a comment from David Blight. We mm-hmm. tend to think, you know, family history and, well, history writ large are two different things. Well, mm-hmm. Mike's call suggests that maybe not.
Well, they're not two different things if indeed we can find a way to mix them. The Hatfield-McCoy feud, as the gentleman said, was a local little civil war in the midst of a much larger, bigger civil war. It is true that most Americans, and I think this is probably true around the world, tend to connect with the past through their family first. That's where we begin to ask these questions. I'm intrigued by the gentleman's comment about terrorist organizations related to the Civil War. He must be referring to the Ku Klux Klan, created during Reconstruction, which was America's homegrown terrorist organization and killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people during Reconstruction. And if we have anything that really is analogous to the kind of memory with which we began the program today, Holocaust survivor memory, the trauma of terrible suffering, it would be the kinds of suffering that Americans went through, largely African Americans, at the hands of organizations like the Ku Klux Klan. The difference, though, is that nobody ever asked for the memoirs or the reminiscences of victims of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. There were no publishing companies eager to print their memoirs. The closest thing we ever had to any kind of judicial proceeding or trial, or for that matter, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, was the Ku Klux Klan hearings of 1870 and 71, which did produce 14 huge volumes of testimony, mostly of victims, but also by some perpetrators. And in those volumes, one can read some of the worst horrors you'll ever want to encounter. That kind of material needs to be a larger part of our popular national memory if we're to really understand the nature of that kind of violence that was conducted during Reconstruction, most of it political violence against African Americans trying to exercise their rights in the South. And I'd just say one other thing. This question of when a person's memory is welcome or what happens to memory when survivors are gone, in some ways it seems to me across the board here, it tends to depend on whether the larger culture finds a way to ennoble that memory or whether the larger culture has done that which may make that memory shameful. Because most survivors of any kind of terrible experience are not likely to express their memories if the larger culture tends to see their experience as some kind of shame. On the other hand, if the larger culture manages to ennoble that suffering, then I think history shows us that we're more likely to get a flowering of that oral history. So that might be one kind of little measure we can take to these issues when we compare them across time and place.
David Blight, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
David Blight is the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. He joined us from the studios at Yale University, and in just a moment, we'll be talking about the Oscars.